We interrupt this program for an important bulletin.
The local news of the week. At midnight Saturday, the telephones in this city will be changed to dial service, and all telephone numbers will be changed. Here are a few important suggestions for the use of your dial telephone.
The revolution is not being televised because it's on your phone. Telephone culture, wireless society, ringtone nation. I dial, therefore I am. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, May 20th. The landline is vanishing. Some down-to-earth talk about the changing relationship between people and their communication devices. Also, Democratic primaries in Kentucky and Oregon. A look at due process for some Texas kids caught in the wheels of justice. And why Florida is burning. That and all the news. Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama are squaring off in Democratic primaries in Oregon and Kentucky today. The former First Lady is expected to win big in the Bluegrass State, where 51 delegates are at stake. Obama is poised for a victory in Oregon with 52 delegates. The people of Sichuan Province, China, are preparing to spend a harrowing night outside after warnings from the government of a major new aftershock. Quentin Somerville reports for the BBC from Chengdu.
Outdoor supply stores have sold out of tents, but still long queues form outside as residents look for supplies. Many will sleep in parks and open spaces tonight. They're too afraid to sleep indoors.
Meanwhile, the dramatic rescues continue in China. A 31-year-old man has been pulled to safety after spending more than a week trapped in the rubble of a power plant in central China. An Iraqi military spokesman says Iraqi troops have moved into Baghdad's Sadr city to seize control. It's the first time troops have been in the Shiite militia stronghold since heavy fighting between the Mahdi army and American security forces broke out in late March. A truce agreement was reached 10 days ago.
Some drama on Capitol Hill today. Alleged torture victim Murat Kurnaz will testify that he was tortured at Guantanamo Bay. German-born Kurnaz was declared an enemy combatant and held at Guantanamo Bay for almost 4 years, even though U.S. investigators couldn't tie him to al-Qaeda. An upcoming Justice Department report concludes the FBI raised concerns about alleged mistreatment of detainees, but was sometimes slow to respond to it. News on the No Child Left Behind law today. A report being released says about half the states, including some of the largest, like California and Pennsylvania, have been procrastinating in meeting the law's proficiency requirements, meaning they face more challenges in meeting goals by 2014. The report says the other half of states are on track.
Stocks were mixed yesterday. Dow gained 41. The S&P added a point, and the Nasdaq fell more than 12 points. It starts the day at 25-16. And for you today, the question is, which candidate do you choose to add a closing line to their speech? Tonight we got two primaries. We're going to get results.
We're going to have two speeches.
We're going to hear speeches.
And we'd like to put words in the candidate's mouth. We'd like for you to put words in the candidate's mouth. Write the closing line for one of the candidates. Let's take a listen to what one person had to say.
Barack for 4 years or Iraq for 100 years. This is Glenn Johnston in New York.
That was a very quick one. We want to hear your response at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
Put words in their mouths. I like that.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. Two primary contests, and you can already feel it. The sense of anticipation and drama is starting to diminish. It's been a long, strange trip to the nomination, and certainly for Democrats, voters are going to the polls in Kentucky and Oregon today. Actually, they're not going to the polls in Oregon. They're licking stamps, I suppose, to vote by mail.
Why is it less exciting?
Well, I think in these two contests, it's true that they can't deliver the nomination to Hillary Clinton.
But
and
that
they
doesn't
probably
mean that people can't be excited about being involved in the process.
Well, people can make their own decision. I think it's probably the case that Barack Obama's momentum can't be stopped by whatever outcome happens, and Hillary Clinton is not going to get the nomination no matter what the outcome. I mean, Barack Obama is counting on a victory in Oregon, where he's way ahead in the polls, and he spent yesterday campaigning in Montana.
Thanks to George Bush's policies, Iran is now the greatest threat to the United States and Israel and the Middle East for a generation. And John McCain wants to double down on that failed policy.
On the other side of the country, Hillary Clinton enjoys wide support in Kentucky, and she spent the day yesterday stumping there.
We know very well we've got two wars. We've got an economy in trouble. We've got the cost of everything going up while incomes are staying the same or even falling back.
Later in the program, we're going to take a look at the rhetorical journey of all the candidates over this long campaign. And we have some disagreements about who's come from where and where have they gone. About that later. But first, what journey have voters been on these many, many months? Pat Gallagher from Louisville, Kentucky, in a primary state today, is an old friend of our program. We thought we'd get him on the line. Good morning, Pat.
Good morning, guys. How are you guys doing this morning?
We're doing great, and it's great to talk to you. It seems like thousands of years ago when we met.
It really does.
And describe for our listeners the journey that you've taken from where you were more than a year ago politically and where you are today.
Well, more than a year ago, I registered Republican and had the opportunity to meet Barack Obama and kind of switch sides here and throw my support behind him. And in that time, I've gotten cross-eyed looks and people questioning, you know, just my loyalties to my sanity, you know, for supporting this guy. And to me, it's a clear choice.
Are the cross-eyed looks diminishing now? Certainly Barack Obama was more of an obscure choice back then.
Yeah,
right?
No, they definitely are. I mean, I was thinking about this. I've seen one man who I know who remained nameless. He's 74 years old, and he saw his first African-American when he came here from Ireland, and somewhat bigoted views, who voted for Barack Obama.
Really? So
yeah.
A lot of people are making the journey with you. Now, when we met, you had shown up on a public document which indicated that you had given, actually, not only were you supporting Barack Obama, but you'd given him $500 as a contribution. Are you still a contributor?
I am. I've realized that I don't think Barack needs my money as much as I do in the economy these days, but I've definitely been supporting him, you know, going out and helping canvas and talk to folks. But Barack, I think everybody knows, has not had much problem getting money.
But he's going to have a problem winning Kentucky. I mean, he may do well in Louisville, your city, but he's not going to win the state.
Yeah, no, everybody here, no one's really expecting him to win the state. But it is interesting. He was here last week, and I think he had somewhere around 10,000 people show up at the convention center. There was a line about five blocks long. Last night, Hillary was here, and I could have gone up at the last minute and gotten a very good seat, which I find interesting.
Yeah, where is that discrepancy from what your view of things are happening in Kentucky and these polls that show Hillary Clinton is 30 points or more ahead of Barack Obama?
Well, I think Kentucky overall is a Republican state. And Louisville is much more Democratic. And so where Barack will probably win hands down in Louisville, I mean, just throughout the state, just like West Virginia, very similar. I think that's where the discrepancy is. And so when people focus on Louisville, Kentucky, just, you know, it's all about Barack.
All right, Gallagher, I got an assignment for you. Think about a closing line for Barack Obama tonight, and we're going to ask you about it at the end of the segment. All right, but hold on there. From Oregon, we've got Sarah Gelzer, who's with us. She's a voter with her own journey, possibly not as expansive as Gallagher's trajectory from Bush to Obama. She's a 34-year-old state representative and joins us now from Corvallis. Sarah, good morning.
Good morning.
Now, where were you a year ago politically, and how have you changed as this campaign has moved forward?
Well, a year ago, like most Oregonians, I never expected that it would be primary day and Oregon would actually matter. So, like most Oregonians, I was watching and paying attention with interest to the presidential nomination process, assuming that by the time we got here, there would be a presumptive nominee, and that's who I would vote for. But I would say probably around January or February, as I was studying the candidates very closely, I found myself more and more committed to Senator Clinton. And there were two points that really pulled me over into her camp pretty firmly. The first, of course, was the incident in New Hampshire where she choked up a little bit when she was speaking and the media kind of came down on her for being emotional. And like many women across the nation, I was outraged.
So you jumped to her defense. You jumped to her defense on that moment.
I did. She is a smart and capable woman, and certainly any male candidate who would get choked up would be seen as sensitive rather than weak. And I think that galvanized me to get more involved in making my own choice. At that point, I was still watching the debates as well and listening to the answers of the candidates. Particularly on the area of health care, it became very clear to me that while they are both fine candidates, it is, in fact, Senator Clinton that has a clear plan to move our country forward and, I think, restore the middle class and help to make sure everybody has access to health care, which is a very important issue to me.
So, Sarah, your journey is from a question mark to focusing on her gender and treatment in the media and health care. Do you have a final line for Hillary Clinton that you'd like to write for her tonight very quickly?
I would say run into the end.
Run into the end. Pat Gallagher, how about a line for Barack Obama?
Change is happening now.
Nice. All right. Pat Gallagher, Obama supporter from Louisville, Kentucky, and Sarah Gelser, the Hillary Clinton supporter in Corvallis, Oregon. Thanks a lot to both of you. Two voters on their own journey on a very long political campaign.
From the Democrats to the Republicans, presumptive Republican nominee John McCain, well, he's been cleaning house lately. In short order, five of his campaign employees resigned over links to lobbying activities. The ties are incredibly intricate. Trying to maintain his image as a reformer, McCain has created new rules for his campaign, barring currently registered lobbyists from working on his presidential efforts. That's meant sifting through records, but the man in charge of the rules himself has some lobbying ties of his own. Kate Czernicki of the New York Times has been following the trends. And Kate, where do we start? McCain's general co-chairman, his deputy finance chairman, chief foreign policy advisor, finance director, all of them with links to lobbyists.
Right, exactly. Don't forget Charlie Black, who's a senior advisor and who really kind of pioneered in Washington this trend that's now become very common of working for campaigns in the even-numbered years. And then in the off years, you go and you lobby and you just sort of there's a very clear door between these two paths. I think the interesting distinction was earlier the people that McCain was trying to get rid of on the campaign were people who had ties to Burma and who really lobbied against things that McCain stands for. What he's now saying is if you lobby at all, you do not have a place on this campaign, which is really going to target a lot of people.
And why now? Because clearly he's been facing a lot of criticism in the last several months about his campaign staff and those who have either been lobbyists or still maintain some tie to a company that does some lobbying. What do you think the impetus was?
Well, I think you're right that McCain has this image as a reformer, which is crucial to his bid, and he wants to preserve that. But I also think that he's now focused his sights on Barack Obama and wants to try to get a moral advantage over Barack Obama, and he's going to say, Obama says he doesn't take money from lobbyists, but he doesn't have a policy as clear as mine. He still has lobbyists working for him. I do not.
And for every rule, there's always exclusions, right? And is there some exclusion I thought I read here that involves lobbying for foreign business people?
That's not the exclusion. Is that you can't be a registered lobbyist or be a registered foreign agent, which means you lobby for foreign countries. But there is an exclusion where if you are a part-time volunteer on the campaign or a volunteer on the campaign, you just have to disclose what your lobbying is. If you are getting paid by the campaign, you cannot also be paid by your lobbying clients. But if you are just a volunteer, the McCain policy says you just have to disclose your ties to lobbyists.
Kate Czernicki, thank you. Kate Czernicki is a reporter for the New York Times, and I have no doubt we'll be talking to her sometime soon.
Oh, yes, I think so. You know, it's interesting because the McCain and the Republican Party is committed to the big donors, not the small contributors. So in some sense, their best strategy for raising money is to deal with lobbyists because they are the ones with the speed dials.
And we should mention, of course, it's not just Republicans who have lobbyists in their midst.
That's true. Mark Penn got in trouble with
on the Democrat side, and as you say, a very important part of the Clinton campaign.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. Perhaps you've seen the disturbing pictures. If you're a resident of Florida, you've no doubt seen the colorful sunsets, but the formerly swampy, muddy South Florida Everglades are ablaze. Amidst the worst drought there since the 1930s, more than 36,000 acres have been scorched. Heavy smoke is blanketing southern Florida and parts of Miami. The flames are threatening the habitat of one of the nation's most endangered birds, the Cape Sable Sparrow. Wildfires are considered a natural growth cycle for the Everglades, but there's also been plenty of human manipulation of that habitat down there. We turn now to Mike Grunewald, author of The Swamp, The Everglades, Florida, and The Politics of Paradise, for some insight into the history of manipulation down there. And what are we to make of the national treasure of the Everglades these days? Mike, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, the Everglades ablaze is natural in the sense that, there are fires periodically down there, but how much have humans manipulated the situation in the Everglades?
Well, they were natural fires, but they weren't in May. this is the height of our dry season. We used to get in the natural Everglades, which was, and it was natural not that long ago. You had fires all the time in the rainy season, which starts in June and really picks up in the heat of the summer. But the idea, those were started by lightning strikes. These fires are started by people not only with matches but with crazy water management systems. This is really the bill for 100 years of history coming due.
Can you describe that history, though? What did we find the Everglades as? Then what happened, and what are we trying to do to correct it?
Well, it's people don't realize, now that South Florida is this incredible megalopolis with 7 million people and 50 million annual tourists, and it seems like 100 million golf courses and Jiffy Lubes and Taco Bells. But, in 1880, this was America's last frontier. There were 1 million people living in New York City. There were 257 people living in South Florida. This was just...
Wow.
People called it this hellish, abominable, impenetrable swamp, and nobody really thought that anybody would ever be able to live here. What's happened over the last 100 years is this extraordinary water management system has risen up. You got 2,000 miles of levees and canals. You got pumps powered by engines so powerful that they had to be cannibalized from nuclear submarines. And they've essentially kind of grabbed hold of just about every drop of water that falls on South Florida and whisked it into a lake or into an estuary, which has had tremendously bad consequences for those lakes and estuaries, but has also essentially lost that storage. Water used to be on the land all year long, and now we have too much when we don't need it, and we have not enough when we do need it.
Well, Mike, why can't they just turn on the motors and flood the places that are burning and, be done with it if they've got it so controlled?
Because they've already dumped it out to sea. we don't like it. Half the Everglades is gone, and those used to be wetlands, and now they're highways and driveways and fairways, and so those areas that used to be wet are now dry, and so we don't have the storage anymore. That water's been dumped out to sea. Those wetlands that used to recharge aquifers, no longer exist. So now when the rains don't come for a while, instead of having this kind of reserve, this cushion, not only in the wetlands but also in the lakes, all that water is gone, and so you get these the Everglades becomes this tinderbox, and this land that used to be considered a morass, a bog, a swamp, is suddenly burning. And you mentioned the 30s, which was the probably the last drought we had this bad. There were kids in Miami, just like today, with the smoke hovering over Miami. Back then, the kids the kids couldn't go to school without wet handkerchiefs over their faces.
Mike, just to follow up on what you're talking about, what's happening today, I've seen that lots of environmentalists say that the Everglades is really, there's a really big test there, which is if we can save the Everglades, then there's hope for saving other parts of the planet. Why such a critical, that's a pretty strong statement to make.
Well, I think that's right. I do think that South Florida is kind of where we're going to figure out whether man can live in harmony with nature. I mean, I think part of it is just that we have right now this incredible, we're now up to a $12 billion restoration project. It's the largest ecosystem restoration effort in the history of the planet, where we're going to try to restore the water of the Everglades, not only for the gators and panthers, but for the people and farms around it. So I think that's one reason people think of it as a test. But really, I mean, when you think about South Florida, where you have all this money, it's the most studied wetland in the world, so you have plenty of science. You get 60 inches of rain down here. So people talk about how water is going to be like the oil of the 21st century. Well, we've got plenty of it to play with down here. We've got 3 million acres already in the public domain, so there's this great canvas to kind of paint this restoration masterpiece. But most of all, you have this incredible political commitment. The Everglades is the most beloved wetland in the world.
And it's on fire, at least 36,000 acres of it. Mike Grunwald is a senior correspondent for Time, the author of The Swamp, The Everglades, Florida, and The Politics of Paradise. Thanks for joining us, Mike.
Now for more headlines from Femi Okeh. Femi?
At 28 minutes past the hour, I've just got off the telephone with the 7 Area Incident Team. They're actually looking at the Florida fire, doing all the press for that. It's about 30% contained, 40,000 acres burned so far. But the whole Everglades National Park area is 1.5 million acres. So they're saying they've got a good handle on the fire today, but they want the winds to drop. Elsewhere around the nation, parents of more than 460 children seized from a Texas Mormon compound want answers on how to get their children back. And polls in Kentucky have been open for about an hour and a half. Hillary Clinton is expected to win Kentucky. Voter Tiffany McIntyre says she voted with her heart.
I really don't care about Brock. I mean, he has good issues also, but I care for Hillary. She won my heart at the beginning.
While voter Aaron Williamson says he went with his head.
When the Clintons were in there before, it seemed like there were always a lot of jobs and everything was going real good. And Obama seems like he's a pretty good fella, but I don't know a lot about him.
As Myanmar starts 3 days of mourning, the survivors of Cyclone Nargis get a rare official visit from Burma's reclusive leader, General Than Swee. The UN says 2.4 million people need assistance, and they've only managed to get aid to about 10% of them. Investigators hope a dig starting today in the California desert will answer lingering questions about the Charles Manson case. Searchers are looking for possible grave sites at the ranch where Manson and his followers hid out. And that's a look at your news headlines.
You love that true crime stuff, Femi.
I love it. I know.
Tabloid stuff.
Oh,
we're asking
don't
a takeaway
get me started.
Question. We're asking a question today. Put words in the mouths of candidates, if you like. Write the sort of wind-up zinger last line of a primary speech to be heard tonight. Write a final line for a candidate speech. Pick Obama, Clinton, or McCain. 877-8-MY-TAKE. We'll read them on the air.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, now featuring Father's Day, a short film about a woman whose father left her when she was a child, and her daughter, who now wants to meet her estranged grandfather, if he lives long enough. Available at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, May 20th, and an interesting report here from the Associated Press saying that inflation at the wholesale level slowed in April, and that's following a huge increase in March. So we'll clearly follow that and figure out where that's heading. But right now, we're going to head to Texas and the case of the 463 children who have been taken from their homes, this following a raid on a religious sect following allegations of sexual abuse. And we're talking about a polygyny sect there in Texas.
Polygamy.
Polygyny, which essentially is talking about where men can only have multiple spouses and not women also. Anyhow, those children were placed in temporary foster care and group settings. Marcy Hamilton, a professor of constitutional law at the Benjamin Cardozo Law School, has been following the case closely. And, Professor, let's start with what's happening right now.
These hearings are intended to determine whether or not the parents will permanently be separated from the children. But the middle step is to figure out if there's a family service plan that might work where you could reunite the parents with the children in a non-abusive situation.
Let's back up just a little bit. So there was a raid based on a telephone call, according to officials, by a teenage girl who claimed that she was in trouble.
Yes.
The children were removed, 463 of them, and then there were reports of a DNA process so that they could identify which children belonged to which parents. For 463 children, that is a gargantuan task for any government, but particularly one as small as the one there in Texas. So how have they determined what parents belong to what child?
No, they still have over 100 children. They don't know who the parents are, and they will get the DNA tests of all the individuals by the end of this month, maybe into next month.
And what clearly the parents are going to be told how they may be able to regain custody of their children. Now, will that happen now, or are we not at that step yet?
Well, in these hearings, they've been discussing the possibility that they might be able to be reunited with their children if certain conditions are met. And the state has to be assured that there will be no likelihood of abuse. And so part of what was going on yesterday at these hearings was figuring out whether or not the state and the parents could work out terms where the children would be safe, but the parents would be willing to participate.
Now, the allegations are of statutory rape, right?
Well, the allegations are thus far of a rape. The state released information that indicates there may be physical abuse, and some of the boys have said they were sexually abused as well.
According to officials there?
According to officials in court hearings.
And so the parents, through some of their attorneys, have said that none of these allegations are true, that they have just been targeted because of their religious beliefs and so on. Can you describe what's at their disposal as they move forward?
Well, they're arguing two things. They're arguing they've got a due process right for different kinds of hearings than they've already had. But there's not going to be much of a due process argument now. They're getting individual hearings regarding the status of each child within each family. And then the other argument that they've been trying to raise is that there's some kind of religious persecution here. But given that you've got 31 girls that are underage and are pregnant or have already been pregnant, the charges of statutory rape are relatively easy to make.
Well, because it's a strict liability offense, right? In other words, either the girl is under 17 or she isn't. It doesn't matter what the intent of the person is who had sexual intercourse with her.
Exactly.
Let's take a listen to what one child's advocate had to say, Joanna Scott, about very critical about what's happening there.
There was abuse in the Catholic Church. We didn't go into parishes, take all the kids to decide, was this boy abused by this parish because they attended that church? We didn't do that. We wouldn't even think of doing that. But we have done that here.
But that case is a little different. I mean, what's your thought on those who have been really critical of the way that Texas officials have acted? In fact, I really should have started with this question as to whether or not it was a legitimate caller who cried for help in the beginning, triggering all of this legal action.
Well, there have been serious questions raised about whether or not the initial calls made to authorities were by someone within the sect or not. But there doesn't seem to be any question that authorities had good faith when they went in originally. They had every reason to believe there was a 16-year-old girl who was being abused, and both physically and sexually. And once they got in there, they had to trust their own eyes, and what they saw was girls who were pregnant. And they then continued with the search and found documents that indicated a large number of wives for individual men and underage girls listed as wives.
Marcy, can I ask a quick question about the power of the state? I mean, in a situation where there is no specific allegation from a boy or a girl about abuse and no sort of evidence, is simply the matter of them being in the compound prima facie evidence of abuse? Can the state remove them simply because of the circumstances and the kinds of behaviors that are known to go on in that building?
Sure. I mean, of course, we're not in that situation here because there's plenty of evidence of abuse the state's already put together. But if you're asking, you know, if there's an individual child, could you argue that they aren't at risk because they don't apparently suffer from abuse at this moment?
Right.
Sure. I mean, I've likened this to what if authorities went into a drug den or a crack house and they saw children that didn't look like they were being abused at the moment. Do you leave the children in such an obviously illegal situation where the adults do not seem capable of protecting the children from abuse? I think that perfectly describes what's going on here. And the attempts to argue that this is either like the Catholic Church was just, it's just a silly argument, or that this is like a neighborhood, are also unpersuasive because this is a group that has decided to live isolated from society. They do not live in individual homes. They live in barrack-style housing. And they don't communicate with anybody outside the community.
We'll have to leave it there. Marcy Hamilton, professor at the Benjamin Cardozo School of Law. Thank you. And now, time for more headlines from Femi Oke. Femi?
It is 21 minutes to the hour. Kentucky goes to the polls in a Democratic primary while Oregonians mail in their ballots. Doctors from Japan, Germany and Italy are on their way to help with the earthquake recovery effort in central China. A portable hospital from Russia arrived today. And thousands of quake survivors are preparing to spend the night out in the open after the government warned them that a strong aftershock is coming. And some good news, according to the Chinese state media, an earthquake victim has been found alive after being trapped in a collapsed building for more than a week. The trial of Tariq Aziz, Saddam Hussein's former deputy prime minister, is to start back on again today. The trial was postponed for 3 weeks after Aziz demanded a new legal team. Aziz is accused of the 1992 execution of 42 merchants. An explosion has rocked a San Diego hotel, which is being currently built. More than a dozen workers have been hurt in the blast, five of them critically. Maurice Luque is a spokesperson for San Diego's Fire Rescue Department.
They were surprised that there weren't more injuries, and they were somewhat surprised that maybe there wasn't a fatality or two because of the magnitude of the explosion.
And that was Maurice Luque, who's a spokesperson for San Diego's Fire Rescue Department. Sorry, I misspoke there.
Well, the Chileans will be happy that you corrected that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. Primaries in Kentucky and Oregon today. The outcome, perhaps not decisive, but an important indicator of where the campaign is. And it's been a long, long campaign with lots of transformations. We've talked to voters, and we want to look at the transformations of candidates. And the best place to look there is in the speeches, the sort of last lines, the kind of zinger wind-up lines of speeches. Obama has made something of a transformation since January 4th when he spoke in Iowa, in Maryland on February 12th, and North Carolina on May 6th. Listen to these three cuts.
They said this day would never come. But on this January night, you have done what the cynics said we couldn't do.
We have now won east and west, north and south, and across the heartland of this country we love.
When we are told that we cannot bring about the change that we seek, we answer with one voice. Yes, we can.
In that transformation, I hear a dream becoming a reality, it seems to me.
I think so, but it's all on one theme, which is all about hope. I think most memorable there will be the yes, we can. And just really quickly, interesting note, by the end of the day, when they count all the votes, Barack Obama may have the majority of all pledged delegates at that point.
That's right. Not enough to nominate, but certainly a milestone.
And Hillary Clinton expected to do really well in Kentucky today. Her transformation from New Hampshire on January 8th to Ohio in March to Pennsylvania in April is slightly different than Barack's. Let's listen.
Over the last week, I listened to you, and in the process, I found my own voice. For everyone who has stumbled but stood right back up, and for everyone who works hard and never gives up, this one is for you. Now, we can only keep winning if we can keep competing with an opponent who outspends us so massively. So I hope you'll go to HillaryClinton.com and show your support tonight.
Much more of a personal narrative there.
A personal narrative, but also a transformation, because she was definitely the one to beat, and slowly but surely she was facing some serious challenges.
A very different transformation for John McCain. Here he is, January 8th in New Hampshire, then January 29th, and finally in Texas on March 4th.
My friends, you know, I'm past the age when I can claim the noun kid, no matter what adjective precedes it. But tonight, we sure showed them what a comeback looks like. My friends, in one week, we will have as close to a national primary as we've ever had in this country. I intend to win it and be the nominee of our party. We don't hide from history. We make history. That, my friends, is the essence of hope in America. Hope built on courage and faith and the values and principles that have made us great.
He seemed shocked to win in the beginning, but now it's straight on till November.
You keep saying that. It just sounds to me that he's starting to borrow language from other candidates as he moves forward. We want to hear what line you would write for a victory speech tonight. 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age. Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. We have headlines on this Tuesday, May 20th from Femi. Okay, Femi.
I'm making news this hour at 12 minutes to the hour. We have news from home and abroad. Kentucky residents are heading to the polls while Oregon voters mail in their ballots in today's Democratic primary race. China braces for aftershocks from last week's deadly quake. The World Bank says no to loans for cyclone-devastated Myanmar, and Iraqi troops push deep into Sadr City. Now, earlier on in The Takeaway, we were talking about the Everglades National Park and the wildfires there. I've just come off the phone to CJ Norville. She's looking at the wildfires and the very latest from that area.
Things today are looking better. There was just a sense of people feeling more confident. Miami has had some dense smoke advisories for the past several days. We've been warning people about the hazards from smoke. Stay in if they can.
And John and Adora, they're actually seeing little bits of ash coming down in the air in Miami. And this fire is known as the Mustang Corner Fire, and it's burned about 40,000 acres. Mm. But when you think of the Everglades National Park, it's 1.5 million acres. So when I was talking to their publicity people out there this morning, they said that it's contained and they're hoping if the wind just drops down, they'll be able to get a grip of it. But it's unusual for a fire to run for 6 or 7 days. Usually they get it done and cleared up in 3 or 4 days.
Well, it's an indication that all that swampy stuff, when it dries out, is really, really a lot to burn. For sure, moss burns. Thank you, Femi.
You're very welcome.
Boy, it's hard to imagine now But when the world went from operator-assisted phone calls, when you had to say, "Hello, operator, give me Central. Hello, Central."
I can't say that I personally recall that.
Yeah, well,
actually,
I do,
John.
Of course. Yeah, when I was down there in the beginning. But when the world went from operator-assisted phone calls to the dial phone, it was a real big revolution.
Listen for the dial tone. It sounds like this. That tone indicates everything is ready for your call. With the receiver off the hook, dial the desired number. For example, suppose you want to dial 23650. Dial each numeral in this manner, pulling the dial around to the finger stop each time. Be sure to allow the dial to freely return to its normal position. And this is the ringing signal. If the line is busy, you'll hear this busy signal. Until Saturday midnight, please use your present directory and make your calls in the usual manner.
Usual manner? What does that mean?
It just sounds so archaic.
It's from more than 50 years ago, and today there are some equally revolutionary changes afoot. It's not a surprise to anyone who is not in a persistent coma that we are becoming a cell-centric world. A recent study shows that nearly 3 out of 10 households receive almost all of their phone calls by mobile phone. These are homes that only have a cell phone or rarely accept calls on a landline or traditional phone. But if the landline is on the wane, University of Virginia professor Siva Vaidyanathan says a more compelling chapter in telecommunications is just beginning. Siva, what does it mean when the landline goes away and your address and your phone number is basically part of your identity that you carry with you anywhere?
Well, I think a large number of people are voting for that exact level of convenience. I mean, anyone who has moved to another city, or actually probably more importantly, another part of the same city, and found the frustration of having to re-inform everyone of your new phone number, has found this new system to be quite beneficial. I still carry a 917 phone number that I've had in 4 different cities. I've moved in and out of New York a couple of times since then, and this one 917 phone number has served me extremely well for especially for business contacts. So it really makes sense. This shouldn't be necessarily a surprising figure. Maybe the rate of increase is surprising.
I mean, Siva, let me ask you about a practical implication, though. I mean, it's hard to imagine that there's any way backward where we would start getting rid of our cell phones and move to landlines. But in terms of 911 services, for example, I've seen stories over the years where the problem is that the technology, or at least the technology that many counties or jurisdictions have, isn't up to the date where they can identify exactly where you are when you're making a 911 call on your cell phone. How is that going to work? Because obviously you're potentially putting yourself in danger if you have a cell phone, even if you're in your home.
Yeah, at this point we're looking at about 1,000 to 2,000 feet. If you're in an area with enough cell towers, you can basically be pinpointed by 1,000 to 2,000 feet. And, you know, let's hope that's good enough, right?
Don't, yeah, so that's the exactly NSA, the NSA can figure out exactly where you are, though, right? The Pentagon knows exactly.
Well, actually, no. I mean, they can only figure it out as closely as the cell phone companies can. I mean, they depend on the companies for their data. And you know, that is an important question. And at some point, someone might lose a life over that very gap. I don't know of an example where that's happened yet. But certainly you can imagine that cell phones are involved some sort of trade-off, because if anything, you are quicker to emergency services when you are just outside your home, perhaps, as your home collapses or burns. So, yes.
Yeah, but the real cultural shift that's happening here is all about the fact that communication is not associated with a place. It's associated with your more internal identity. I mean, people associate their ringtones with their name, with their style, with their fashion. And, there's no place in your house where you go to sit and talk on the phone. It happens everywhere. That has broad cultural implications, it seems to me.
Yeah, it has broad cultural implications and implications that we haven't measured. I'm not sure that they're that immediate. I mean, in one sense, the fact that you have your own number and your little brother or little sister might have his or her own number is probably more significant, because a number does become part of your personality and one that you're likely to carry through for many, many years. You know, this is a number like your Social Security number that might be with you from age 12 through 100. So if anything, I don't see a loss with that. I don't see a cost with that. The real question is, how is this affecting our overall communication patterns, how we interact with the world at large? So let me give you one example here. This study identified two big blocks of Americans who are sort of in the mix for this. One, those Americans who have eschewed landlines completely, have decided that landlines are not part of their lives. This group is overwhelmingly poor, overwhelmingly Latino, or overwhelmingly African-American, generally younger. So low-income, minority, more mobile, more transient, etc.
My parents not have done the same thing, though. My parents have done the same thing.
They well, and that's the, other segment. The other segment of this, if you take this 30% we're talking about half of them are that first group, people who don't have landlines at all. The other half are people who pay for landlines but don't use them for voice communication. And this actually is pretty close to what happens in my household, where we have a landline because DSL is the only reasonable – digital subscriber lines are the only reasonable high-speed internet option, and you need it for an alarm system or some other reason or, you know, just out of habit. You just keep it around for a while because you've always had it. So, you know, those are two – but in those cases, these are people who just never pick up the phone because they figure it's a telemarketer or a pollster or somebody else who's annoying, somebody who doesn't really know them and therefore doesn't have their prime number with them. And that means two things. One, I mean, just to be – completely up to date about this. We're talking about Obama supporters on both sides here. We're talking about the fact that, you know, overeducated, highly technologically literate people are not likely to pick up their landlines, and African-Americans are not likely to have a landline increasingly, especially at the younger demographics, and young people overall are less likely to have
all kinds of implications for politics, for how we sort of find each other for various reasons, whether we're talking in public or not. It used to be that if you were talking in public, people thought you were kind of nuts, and now it's just absolutely natural. To say nothing of the fact that conversations you are a part of on the train if you're standing next to somebody. Siva Vaidyanathan, thank you very much for joining us.
Sure thing.
That's great.
And Siva's right, though. I'm definitely one of those people. We have a landline, just like Bill, who wrote to us on his website, and he says, "While it girds me to cough up the $50 plus monthly for a landline I seldom use, we keep it because the cell phone has no equivalent of a family member. While useful for logistic calls, replacing a communal family phone number with individual numbers lands another blow to the family unit. There's no central repository of messages, no chance conversations with the in-laws or friends, no monitoring who is calling into the lives of your teenage daughter, and more."
We got responses immediately on this. "I have had my cell phone number for about 8 years, but I will not give up the landline as long as landlines exist. I want a phone that does not rely on electricity during power failures. You can't count on cell phones," says Tam.
And there's
hate
like
to inform
capital
you.
Letters in yeah, but, that and but exclamation
phones,
points.
Phones use electricity, I'm afraid to. I hate to. I mean,
right, but
do.
What she's
they
saying
have a
in the times of crisis, the cell phones seem to block up or get, you know, are busy a lot in much more common circumstances.
Well, power can go out in phones. Maybe a solar powered radio device is perhaps what she's looking at.
Well, keep your responses coming because we love hearing from you. 877-8-MY-TAKE, mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Yesterday, Adora spoke with director Purvis Sharma about his documentary, A Jihad for Love. The conversation is continuing at thetakeaway.org. You can join that.
And last week, you may remember, we talked about celebrating the 40th anniversary of the cubicle. Now, some of your pictures are on a slideshow online right now with commentary from design critic Debbie Millman. So check that out.
If you missed anything else this morning, it's all on our podcast. That's from thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its American Worker Initiative. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science. Neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.